Welcome to the Sexier Than a Squirrel podcast, the podcast that turns dog training on its tail with a whirlwind of fun and games that achieve real life results for you and your dog. Each episode is a treasure trove of inventive games-based training solutions supported by our Games Club, the ultimate dog training membership with a team of pro dog trainers helping you every step of the way 24/7. Think of us as your go-to squad of dog experts. I'm Lauren Langman, a top-level agility competitor. I've competed and won all over the world and at the largest show in the world, Crufts, with my superstar Blink. I'm a Sunday Times best-selling author, owner of one of the largest dog training facilities in the whole of the UK and a founder of the Sexier Than a Squirrel Challenge, a challenge that has helped over 140,000 dog owners just like you to get real-life results. Our team consists of experts in scent work, detection, search and rescue, tracking, agility, obedience, heel work to music, the intricacies of why your dog does exactly what they do, naughty but nice, behavioural problems, and so much more. We're here to help you be the very best dog owner that you can be for your dog. In our world, you'll become more mesmerising to your dog than the juicy, marinating steak on the counter or the mysterious smelly thing on the side of the road. Yes, you really can become even more tantalising than fox poo and even the local jogger. Our mission? We know how to make you the apple of your dog's eye by tapping into the transformational power of play and learning through games. Whether you're wrangling a bitey, sharky puppy or teaching an old dog new tricks, the Sexier Than a Squirrel podcast is packed with creative strategies and supporting advice for you. Become the most thrilling part of your dog's world. Ready, set, play. Welcome to the Sexier Than a Squirrel podcast, powered by the Games Club.
Today, I'm joined by the wonderful Anne McLean, and you're one of my favourite people to talk about. Partly because we both have the love of brown dogs and we definitely both have the joy of brown dogs. And secondly, you know what? You just have so many awesome stories, so much awesome experience. And I always love our chats. We're going to do it over Prosecco and cheese. We are going to do that.
I am definitely going to hold you to that because I can't imagine how much fun we would have actually in person with the brown dogs and Prosecco and a little bit of cheese.
Let's do it. So today, Anne, we're going to be talking about recall, specifically really recall with hunting dogs, because so many dogs that I meet, you know what, recall can be a little bit of a challenge with the majority of dogs. But when you get a dog who's hard hunting, and when you get a dog with instinct, and when you get a dog who really has found the joy in hunting, it can become pretty non-existent. And I'm going to just give a really tiny story. I remember being out a good few years ago now with a friend of mine. We were walking a couple of my spaniels and then some of their spaniels, and they all took off on a bit of a hunt. It was a deer. It was an injured deer. I don't know how the deer had been injured. It was a little bit lame. And they really took it upon themselves and they were strong hunting. And I've never seen anything quite like that until you actually see that. And I remember telling a gameskeeper about it happening. And he was like, "You must never let that happen. You must never do that." And I was like, I didn't see the deer. I didn't know it was there. I got them on lead the second I could. And you know what? The way that they were, it's like nothing else. It's like the red mist is down. It's like you cannot communicate when they're in that space. And obviously, since that time, we've worked differently with recall. We've worked differently with skills. But I think it's worth sharing our experiences here because I know that so many people struggle with dogs when they get hunting.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know what? It's not easy. That's the thing. It's not easy. But you hit the nail there on the head. These dogs, whether it's a spaniel, whatever kind of hunting dog it is, actually, I mean, my experiences with spaniels, brown ones, of course, between my Sussex, which are very hound-like. So hounds are hunting dogs as well, of course. And then Millie, my little working cocker, but it could be any dog that has that inherent drive to hunt, and they're dogs. So virtually all of them do to some extent at just different levels. And once they turn on and they get into that space, reaching them, it can be really, really hard. It's something that I think as owners, we have to be aware that that exists in our dogs, especially dogs that were bred specifically for hunting, and to build that relationship, to build that that communication, to really observe our dogs, man, when they're from puppies, they're puppies, right? So start playing those games and, and building that proximity, building that relationship, and really observing your dog to seeing if it's the scent on the ground that turns them on. Is it a visual stimuli that turns them on? What is it that turns them on? And then you can start putting things in place to catch it before it happens a lot of times.
Because I'm just thinking of this experience, and you triggered it in me there. I am working with an amazing young dog. Like, she is phenomenal. And I was working with a guest trainer. The guest trainer was here, and she said she wanted them. And we're doing agility, but it's no different. Recall, I'll tell you how recall comes into this. She said to me, can you get her to wrap around the wing? And I was like, yeah, I can get her to wrap around the wing. She's like, can you get her to wrap around the wing when there's food on the floor? I was like, yeah, I can get her to wrap around the wing when there's food on the floor. She's like, can you get her to do it when there's a ball on the floor? Yeah, I can get her to wrap around the wing. She said, can you do it with the ball thrown? So I threw the ball and I asked her to do the wrap. There was nothing. Like, there was nothing. So what the trainer did was grab the ball, which seems like the logical thing to do. Oh my goodness, I lost her head. I didn't just lose her head a little bit. I lost her head for the rest of the day. Like, she had, it was so far gone to the point that even when the trainer did show her she had the ball, she was so hunting that arena for that ball that she didn't care that the trainer had shown her the ball. She, in her head, was hunting a ball out, and she didn't know where it was, and she was gone. And there was nothing reining her back in that moment. I could show her the ball. We had to pick her up and take her home. She was going home because she'd gone. Yes. That hunt switch had turned on, that I am searching this out had turned on, and there was nothing that was going to like interrupt that. You weren't recalling her. You weren't stopping her. You weren't dropping her. And I think it's good for people to hear, like, my answer to that was, she is going home. There is no, let's try and work through that. I think trying to work through it would only have made it worse in the environment. I think it would have made it worse. Sleeping.
Yeah. The other thing about that, and I noticed this with Millie, actually, when we were working on retrieve things, if she broke, right, she wasn't steady, the traditional thing is to go pick up the retrieve, like the trainer did with the ball. Actually, for Millie, was super, and it works for a lot of dogs, it was super punishing. And I got a lot of the same response. I got, I'm hunting, I'm not going to pay attention to you. It was so averse to do that, to pick it up. I can do it now because we've built a relationship of trust and she gets the game now. But when I first did that, it was like the fallout, the consequence, I had no idea. It was like, wow, something so simple she found so averse. And it just completely backfired. So knowing your dog and seeing the fallout of what you do, yeah, it's pretty powerful learning for us as owners. I completely changed my tactic on that setup.
And I think it is, isn't it? It's knowing the ability to change your tactic as well. So I think let's play around with a bit of tip tennis on some of our tips as to getting a really great recall with a hunting dog or a hard hunting dog. And I would say that she's a hard hunting dog. So she would hard hunt. She would hard hunt. She would get in gorse. She would get in bushes. She would go underground. She would be a hard hunter. She would ferret around. Another example of this, we were doing scent work games with a wonderful Dave, who I know thinks loads of you, Anne. He thinks you're literally, and you guys both are brilliant pro dog trainers. He was doing some scent work with me. We'd done a tennis ball, piece of cut up tennis ball in a scent wall. And she'd really hard like searched it out. And when she got it, I threw in her tennis ball and she was like, I don't want this tennis ball you just thrown in. I want what I found. And she really wanted what she found. And I could have kept trying to reward her with the tennis ball, which was exactly the same brand. It was an Aircong tennis ball. It's cut off the same like packet. There were three of them. I cut up one. The other one was in my hands. So it's the value in what she'd done. She'd done the work, wanted the value in the work. So I picked out that piece, I played with it, I made that the huge value. And then I kept that piece and I put the other tennis ball in the thing. And I put up, like, you know what? I think the thing I would say, my learning from all of this is when you've got a hard hunting dog, you need to know what is rewarding to them and you need to work with what's
rewarding. Absolutely. And yeah, that possession. And when you find the thing, the possession, here's the cool thing. It kind of comes for me. A lot of it comes down to the hunting together aspect of it. So I have a dog that's going to hunt. So I want to use that power of that skill that she has, but I want us to do it together. So I have to make myself relevant in my dog's world. I was helping somebody the other day and they were asking, you know, they were sending their dog out on a retrieve and they wanted to stop their dog. couldn't stop the dog because the dog was like, I know it's out there. And so the dog just went, ignored the whistle, just hunt, got the thing, got reinforced, found the thing, came back. Now, Millie's done this too, of course. So this is how I figured it out. So I will play the game with her and she believes I've hid something and I haven't, but I've hid something somewhere else and she hasn't seen me do it. So I send her, and if she doesn't obey the whistle right away, she's not going to get reinforced by finding a thing, and she'll come back and she'll like, oh, I kind of goofed that up, didn't I? Huh? I can send her again, stops on a dime, and then I cast her and voila. Hey, I just became relevant because mom helped me find something. So I want to bring myself into whatever game I'm playing. I want to bring myself into the game and become relevant in their world. We had, you know, and most people who've heard me on here before know that my background's in search and rescue. And one of the, my first dog was a wilderness air scent dog who's working offline. And Millie works offline and she does air scent as well. So the dog is hunting for something they really want, right? The tennis ball, the person in this case, but they have to tell you about it. And usually when they make that find, they're a considerable distance away from you. So for some dogs, it can be a considerable distance. Now, tradition is what's called a bark and hold, where they bark at the person. In today's world, in today's environment, it's not necessarily the safest way to communicate to the handler because you don't know the mental state of the person who's been found. And so another traditional thing is called the recall refind, where they come back to get you and then they bring you to what they found. That's all about communication, right? It's all about communication. So before I forget, I have this really funny story because I kind of go off on these tangents. So Millie and I did a field trial a couple of weeks ago now. Oh, she hunted. The judges loved her until the end, right? She's hunting beautifully. She's worked. She honored her brace mate who put up a bird. She was beautiful. She got wind of a pheasant and she's hunting it hard and she puts this pheasant up and it just beelines off the course and she's gone. She runs in. She's just gone. She's lit. I swear she must have run 100, 200 meters off course. And I'm like looking at the judge. Yeah, I guess I'm done. And she's run off. She doesn't put any other birds up. She's totally focused on this bird. And here's the funny thing. She's off there. I'm just kind of standing there waiting for my dog to come back. And she comes back. And she does a recall refind on the pheasant. And I didn't catch it right away. She came in, gave me her eye contact, gave me her sit, and took off again. And I'm like, oh my God, what did I teach my dog? This is actually brilliant. And she came back to me. And when she came back the second time, I quickly leashed her up. But I'm like, she could have stayed out there. And this happens, I know, to a lot of Spaniel owners. Their dog goes AWOL and their dog could have stayed out there. She could have stayed out there all day flushing this bird.
You were part of the game.
I was part of her game. And she came back to tell me, come hunt with me, Mom. I have found the pheasant. And I actually thought it was quite brilliant. Obviously,
I have a lot of work to do. I love it about you as an owner because so many people wouldn't spot it, Anne. So many people would be looking for the bad. You are looking for the good in our hunting dogs. So my next tip here would be with our hunting dogs, don't get in that situation until you are skilled. Like, let's not, like my Spaniels, I live in pheasant territory, like the up in the air. And I mean, even my collies put pheasants up now. They've all, like Tokyo is a pheasant beast. He's like looking like a sleeping monkey right now, but he's a pheasant beast. He loves a pheasant. He stalks pheasants. He points pheasants. I'm like, who taught you to point? He loves pheasants. Brave loves pheasants. Like they all love pheasants. Easy loves pheasants. And even Classic loves a pheasant. And so I would say so many of us put our dogs in these spaces before they have the skills. I can call mine off pheasants. I can call them off cats. I can call them off cows. I can call them off sheep. I think that so many people put them out there. And I would say my young dogs, I don't put them in pheasant territory until I've got my basic games implanted, my club games, my PDT games, my gun dog games, my games. Same as you, right?
Yeah. And I think you all are so fortunate. Here's the thing. You're fortunate because you have pheasants everywhere, right? I remember when I came over, it was like, there are pheasants everywhere.
Everywhere.
It's not like that here in the US. The pheasants that our dogs, that unless you have access to them all the time, you might see them at training. So they become novel, exciting. It's kind of like the decoy and protection work, right? It's like, wow, that is such an exciting thing. So you're fortunate, and owners in the UK are fortunate, is they can manage their dogs in the meantime as they're playing the games and desensitizing their dogs to the novelty factor of the pheasants or the pigeons or whatever game that there is, and making it not, it's not going to take away drive. It's not going to take away instinct. It's not going to do any of that, but it's going to keep them thinking, keep them in a safe head space. So yeah, my dogs are, I mean, even Millie, but especially my Sussex, who when they get a scent, they can just kind of be houndy and gone. They're on a 40-foot line through all their puppy development. And that 40 feet now becomes my proximity zone where you're good in here. Just stay in here, check in with me. We reinforce check-ins all the time. We hunt together. We play little games. And they learn that 40 feet is awesome. And then when they do earn the freedom and they get that freedom, it hasn't diminished their drive to go away from me. In fact, it's like, wow, now mom's telling me to go away from me. This is going to be really, really fun now. So it comes back through you. It's all that pre-max stuff.
Yeah. I think that's brilliant. And I think that's really vital. Like for my dogs, same thing. They get to do it, but through me. So yes, we can do it through me. And there's a permission base in there. So no, yes. Free hunting. And I've got a little story to add here. A great friend of both of ours, Tash, and one of her spaniels really legged it. And she legged it hunting for a good couple of hours. The panic that goes through you, the panic. And I think for me, if you have got into that recall territory, because obviously recall is a big deal. If you have got into that recall territory where they are going to hunt, let's not let them rehearse it again. So let's actually break. And let's take them out of that scenario and let's not let them do it again. And she was brilliant. The minute that happened to her and she lost the dog for a few hours and the dog was turned up at a vet's miles away. Mm. When you have had that scenario, she then took it right back and stripped it right back and then came up with a bit of a recall program. She was like, you're not doing that to me again. So if you need to, don't be scared to strip it back. What you mustn't do, in my honest opinion, and I'm sure you're going to back this, I would not allow them to continue learning to hunt without me. So they mustn't learn to hunt without me. And the same for Dave, the police officer that we work with, or he works with obviously operational police dogs and all force dogs actually. Don't let them rehearse what you don't want without you. It's the same as letting a dog, I don't know, go and herd sheep without you or go and do bite work without you. You just don't, you're part of the game, right?
Right. You have to be part of the game. Absolutely. Yeah. I wouldn't, you know, once, God, that must've been so scary for Tash. I can't even imagine how frightening that must be.
It's horrific. I mean, I've only lost a dog like who's actually heard a bang and jumped over our garden. To lose them out hunting is like another level, isn't it? Because you know, when they're hunting, they're not looking at anything they're doing. They're not thinking. Right. They're hunting. So if there's a road in their way, they will run over the road. Like if there's
one of the, they're just focused. One of the fun things that, you know, from my search and rescue background and is I call them lassie loops. So when Millie and I are hunting together and she first gets scent on the wind of who's ever missing, that person could still be a considerable distance. She comes and gets me and does, it's not a formal indication. She just comes and gets me, follow me. I've got it. Trust me. And I respect that and I follow. And now I'm part of that game. And it's so, it's so important. And it was really cool this weekend. I don't know if I mentioned it. I know we have talked about it. I was at a seminar and Millie was the only spaniel there. It was German Shepherds and Mals and Dutchies and Rotties and all these working dogs. And what they were doing, a lot of them were coming out of the protection sport world and were just exploring the IRO, International Rescue Organization, sport SAR programs, what the seminar was about. So they were new to, say, area search. And but to see these dogs, they were just impeccably trained, fabulous owners, everyone aware of their dogs, aware of the space, was phenomenal. But to see these dogs out in the field hunting and to see the control that they all had, because they all had done call-offs off decoys and all this kind of stuff, and see these dogs working under that kind of control, but with fun and joy in their faces, and they were lit up. So it's not just spaniels, you know, it was really impressive. Very nice.
And I love, I when you're even saying the breeds, I'm like, I love a Dutchie, I love a Rottie. Like I love all of those breeds in Mally. I was training a Mally only yesterday, just about 2 days. She was about to be put to sleep and that she was just coming to rehome. What an amazing dog. What an amazing dog, amazing dog to work with. Anyway, back to hunting. I'm going to go back to tip for hunting. And I'm going to say with hunting dogs, I think you need to develop your reinforcers because, you know, when mine get hunting, a piece of kibble doesn't cut it. And sometimes a tennis ball doesn't
cut it.
Right. So let's talk through some of your reinforcers, because I do believe that you've got such a high drive, intense little spaniel who is really cool, but also I feel like you've really mastered reinforcement, as I feel I have with like Tokyo and all of my dogs. I feel like we are masters of reinforcement. And I think reinforcement really matters when it comes to hunting. What do you think?
Absolutely. I think knowing and understanding and having a good reinforcement system is critical to not just hunting dogs and the recall, but for all of our dog training. So I actually, in addition to ranking my reinforcers, kind of knowing which ones my dog likes best, that's going to vary, of course, by activity we're doing and time of day. So the kibble that owners think, hey, my dog will take kibble or a piece of food, when you put them in this environment, in this arousal, it's not cutting it. It is not cutting it, especially when you're up against inherent behavior that's just lights the dog up, the scent dog, the chasey dog, whatever it is. You have to have a reinforcer that you've built up, a system, a pattern of reinforcement, but also something that's going to mimic and replace what they actually want to do. So Millie loves her tennis ball, right? So she loves a tennis ball, like a lot of spaniels. And for a long time, I used to just toss it into her when she would find something, if we were doing detection work. And when I started doing some bird work, finding a rabbit dummy or something like that, I upped what she was finding out in the field. It wasn't really cutting it. And I noticed it. I'm like, this is really interesting. What does she really want to do? She wants to catch it. It's not chasing the ball. So this is really critical, I think. A lot of people think that their dog wants to chase the ball. So we throw it to have them chase it. Some dogs, absolutely, they want that. Other dogs, and this was Millie, she actually wants to catch it. So if she finds the catch and possess part of that, super, super valuable. So she has a marker now, which pulls her away from the thing. So if she finds, say, something exciting in the field, and for her detection work, like firearms, I kind of want her away from finding something like that that's deadly. I have a marker, it's returned. She comes back to me and I drop the tennis ball where she can catch it. And it's mimicking what she really prefers to do. And this has been super, super helpful with our bird work. It's a pattern that she's learned, the pattern away from birds. It's helping her burn off energy rather than chase the bird. She's chasing, running back to me. She's getting to catch something. Now, I will say tennis ball's valuable. What's more valuable, and I had to work actually down to a tennis ball, was that clam toy, the one that opens up with the Velcro and you put the food in it. Yeah. Oh, because then you get to catch, possess, dissect, and eat all at once. And that was massive for her. And now I can use a tennis ball, you know, and now I can use a rabbit ball. So it depends on what the value of that reinforcement is and how it's delivered and where it's delivered. But to build a pattern up, she has taught me a huge amount about reinforcers and marker systems. To tell her, I didn't want her guessing in terms of where reinforcement's going to happen. Do I have permission to go retrieve the bird that's fallen from the sky? or not. Maybe that's somebody else's bird and it's not mine. So I have to let her know. I have to tell her, which is it yours or is it not? Come back to me. It's not yours right now. So yeah, it's massive.
And I think it's really worth, I know the answer to this, but I think it's really worth us just both recapping this. Do you ever need to use aversive training to be able to get this great recall and great response in a hunting dog? So I think a lot of people will quickly, and specifically in the gun dog world and in the hunting world and in the that dog training world, really, I think they're quick to go to aversive methods. Do you feel we need to go to aversive methods, or do you feel like there are enough options to you?
I think this is a really hard question, because I think for 99% of owners, you don't need to. I do think that you have to know your dog. I'm not going to be naive. And you know, if you have a dog that has a history of chasing, that has a history of bothering livestock, you should get the dog on lead. And you shouldn't allow them to rehearse it like we talked about. You know, we'll have to have this discussion and another whole episode maybe on it. It's such an interesting topic. You know, I was at the seminar this weekend, and there were people there that did have things on their dogs that most of us do not put on our dogs. And you know, we were all friendly about it, and I don't know how to put the dogs were having a great time. I hate to say that. I'm not saying what they were doing was wrong. I'm not saying what they were doing was right. I'm just saying, it's a hard topic. It's a hard discussion, and I'm still learning a lot. That's all I'm going to say.
I would say that
you can edit it out.
No, for me, I think I've never needed to go anywhere aversive with my dog's sort of training. And yet I think it's very easily out there. The one thing I would say is that we get really great results when we think hard on reinforcers.
Totally. Absolutely. And it makes you a better dog trainer. It makes you a better connected to your dog, more communication with your dog. I mean, I don't use aversives on Millie. I don't plan on it. I don't think it's necessary. Will I ever get her steady using just reinforcement-based system? If that's my, I don't know if I will be successful. And if I'm not, that's okay. Right. And so, yeah, it's hard. It is hard. And I'm a pretty good dog trainer. Not a great dog trainer, but I'm pretty good.
You're a great
dog trainer. So I get it. I really encourage folks that if they feel they have 100% recall on their dog, keep the dog during that portion of their walk. Keep the dog safe. Protect the dog's confidence, because that was the thing that was cool about this weekend. When we got out of the car on Saturday, Millie looked around and kind of with her eyes open and kind of went, "Oh my gosh, Mom, these dogs could all eat me." And they probably, and I told everybody, my dog is fast. She moves like a bunny rabbit. And they're prey-driven dogs. And after just a short time, first, you know, half hour, she just mellowed in. She trusted me. I trusted her. All the handlers trusted their dogs. Everybody was respectful. Nobody let their dogs run up to people. I know you had that terrible incident on the horse just recently. People were respectful of each other, respectful of what their dogs could do. And it was a fabulous experience. And Millie loved it and was like, "Hey, this is kind of cool. I can just hang out and heal next to these dogs that are big and powerful."
What were you doing at the weekend? What type of seminar was it?
Oh, so it was it's called the IRO, International Rescue Organization. It's RH. It has a German name, Rettungshunde or something like that. And it's a lot around the world. It's actually a foundational set of requirements for a lot of search and rescue teams, especially those that are going to be doing disaster work. It's not here in the United States. FEMA has their own set of rules, which are quite similar, actually. But it's a sport, and it comes out of a lot of the the obedience and things are very similar to what you might find in IPO. So the healing routine that we had to do was, it was pretty impressive. There was a down with distraction where your dog is in a down and you're like 40 feet away participating in another activity and your dog is maintaining a down. You know, there's a down, moving down in a recall. And we did that with several dogs. We group things where there's dogs moving in circles and you're moving around them. Dexterity, which Millie was, you know, games like when she was a puppy, the balance pads and all those confidence games. Oh, she had no problem on the moving structures or anything like that. She was eating all that up. She loved it. So there's a lot of dexterity in tunnels and chutes and moving things and planks and ladders and all that kind of stuff. And then there's the actual types of scent work. So tracking, a very precision tracking, which is similar to the IDP style footstep tracking, area scent, area searching. But it's all very stylized. And so it really gives you a strong foundation. It was just really fun. It was really, really fun.
I love that. You're so passionate about what you do. So, Anne, I think what we'll do, we'll give everyone a couple more hunt tips, just knowing that hunting and dogs like this, recall can be tough. And I loved your hunting tip about your long line. I thought your long line was a fantastic like tip, and the fact that you would just use your long line and you'd use your long line for potentially a long time. Like you're just going to have it there as a backup, right? For a long time.
Absolutely.
I'm going to say my next tip for everyone listening would be, you know what? Let's not let them learn to hunt from another dog as well. Because if you've got one dog that's hunting, your other dog will pick up hunting. So for me, I only walk my young dogs or my dogs that are learning or my dogs that are in rehab effectively with a dog who behaves well. So if I'm putting them out with a multi-dog group who have got three or four hunting dogs, my dog will quickly pick up that hunting. If you walk your dogs that scream on the lead together, they will all scream on the lead. Like for me, it's like being a little bit logical about let's not let them learn from the wrong people. And I would say my dog's people need to behave like how I want my dogs to behave. Because if not, I feel like, yes, your dog can be a great role model, but not when they don't know it themselves. So if they don't know it themselves, I wouldn't put them out with other dogs that don't know it too. So for example, when I'm walking my youngster, I don't walk her with other dogs that are hunting, screaming, barking, because she'd like to do all three of those. She'd love to hunt. She'd love to scream. She'd love to bark. So right now I don't give her those role models. I think about her role models and I think about her role models carefully. And I'd prefer to walk her alone than to walk her with other dogs that behave like that. Not because I feel bad about the way they behave, because I don't want her to learn the way that they behave. So for me, that's just one of my tips. How about you?
Yeah, I think those are fabulous tips. I'm going to give you a puppy tip. When I first get my puppies and we're walking around the yard or going for a short walk or something like that, and they're just little puppies, I like to, and I know people play this game all around the world, just hide and seek, right? So you hide behind a tree and your dog then starts looking for you. And then you have a party when they find you. The other thing I love about this game is you get to now observe your dog, how they find you. So do they have their head up and they're air scenting, or do they have their head down and they track you and find you that way? Because then as I go from there, it's going to help determine maybe how my dog likes to hunt and how I might want to structure my games as we go forward. So that would be my puppy tip. My adult tip would be to play disengagement games as much as you possibly can. And then when you have that part of the chain, add engagement games. And this could be finding the tennis ball and recalling off the tennis ball, finding a pot of food and recalling off the food, and then going back to it. So building that chain. So if your dog were to think about going after something, you're going to have such a strong pattern built in that they're going to want to come back to you too.
So Anne, just for everyone listening who's maybe new here, what would be, just give an example of what a disengagement game is, and also maybe one of your favorite disengagement games.
So I think the easiest beginning one would be something like a plant pot prison game, right? And this could be a paper cup over a piece of kibble. It doesn't have to be a plant pot. It can be any, it could be your hand, kind of like a version of mouse game, right? And I want my dog to want the thing. So they're going to have to want it. They're going to have to actually want it. And then if they show any disengagement from it, I'm going to give it to them. And this is where a lot of people go wrong. They want to see the entire package all at once. And when I'm looking for disengagement, I might be looking for an ear twitch back or a slight head twitch back or just nose drop. And then woohoo, they get the thing. And it becomes a huge game. Another way you can play this actually without using food or without using a favorite toy, even if you have a dog that you don't want to use those things for whatever reason, or you want to build this behavior on something more, stimulus that doesn't really have a lot of value to begin with, is, you know, that target stick that comes with a manners minders, right? Yeah. So that's usually my target stick. So I teach a really, targeting is such a valuable game for so many things, but I teach a strong target on that. My dog can target that. So I can use that to teach my dog to go out and target something. And then I can hit my return cue and call them back and to disengage off of that. So I can teach the same kind of engage game on something that, again, is that value, right? I might need to start on something that doesn't really have any meaning before I can build up to the tennis ball, the rabbit ball, or the tug toy.
Yeah, it's a bit more neutral to start with, isn't it? It's not got quite the same.
Yeah, it is. Doesn't build the same arousal. And it doesn't potentially, because you have to, I think with some dogs too, you have to be careful that even something as simple as mouse game for some dogs can be a little averse. They're like, whoa, that was too much pressure. I don't really like that game anymore. And then you're kind of like, it takes the joy out of the game. So I always look to see if I have any fallout like that. I might teach mouse game where my hand covers the piece of kibble, but I then give the dog chicken.
Yeah.
Like, hey, now it's become a fun game. Now it's become a much funner game. Yeah. Yeah. So just tweaking things for your dog. Yeah.
Being playful with it, isn't it? It's being playful. So my final tip, I'm going to think of a final one, Anne, and I'm going to go with my final recall tip with dogs that might hunt is, I've got two really. One would be knowing when they need to challenge up, because if you're not challenging up, you're not really training. So for me, I don't want to just practice. I do want to train. So I think knowing when to challenge mm-hmm. them doesn't mean that like they stay at the ground level forever. So that would be the first one for me. Second one would be, I think, being really vigilant and observant of your dogs. So actually really observing them. I think so many people don't observe them well. And they're like, he took me by surprise. I didn't know he'd ever do that. I can't believe he did that. And I'm like, I saw that coming. I saw that coming 100 times over. I saw that coming. Every part of that dog's body and that dog's brain was telling you they were going to do that. So for me, be very vigilant. So I think those would be my final tips. How about you?
Yeah, I like that one about being observant. I had that experience once with Millie, and I saw the nose go down, and I'm like, I'm slow. And she was gone. It was, I think, a squirrel. I don't know what it was, but it was scent driven, right? There was no visual of anything. But if you're observing your dog, you're going to notice that and catch him beforehand. But another tip I guess I would have, and I know you guys have a whistle recall badge, is I use whistle for a lot of stuff. And I think it's an incredibly valuable tool to learn how to use it and to learn how to use it well, because I don't know, you know, you're in the house and you're chit-chatting with your dogs all day long. And what's that? The Peanuts comic, you know, you just kind of become white noise a lot of times. They don't. Yeah. They kind of, we get tuned out really easy. And having clear communication, clear signal, and having a, if that's your if you only use that whistle as an emergency recall, it's going to have an impact, right? But you got to train it.
That is mega. And I really agree. I love the whistle. I love the whistle, particularly with hunting dogs, because I just think it's a unique sound. You can't be angry with a whistle. You can't be frustrated with a whistle. You can't be like upset with a whistle. It's just a whistle, right? And so for me, I love a whistle recall. And I think for a hunting dog, it really cuts above the, it cuts above the like rest. So it's a great space to be. And it's been a mega pleasure having you on the podcast today. I know we've got so much more to talk about. Are you game for coming again?
Oh, absolutely. Always, always. There's game for that. Always.
There's a game for that. I love your accent. It's so gorgeous. Thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Take care.
That was this episode of the Sex and the Squirrel podcast. Literally join us next time. It's going to get a little bit. Oh, I have to wait. I'll tell you next week.